Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Lisa Bloom is familiar to a great many Americans. She is a highly regarded and successful attorney, best-selling author, and television legal analyst. As such, she has appeared on the major TV networks and is currently a regular visitor to the Today Show and NBC News. Lisa Bloom's focus is usually on race and the rights of women and children. Given her bloodlines, this background is not surprising. Her mother is famed women's rights attorney Gloria Allred. Lisa Bloom's early books include Think and Swagger. Her most recent is Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. She'll be talking about the book and St. Louis race and diversity issues tonight at the Missouri History Museum. We'll have more on that later. And it's a pleasure to welcome Lisa Bloom to our studio. Lisa, so nice to see you.
Well, what a nice introduction. Thank you so much, Don.
Well, it's good to have you, and welcome to St. Louis. And as you said when you came in, go Cardinals.
Go Cards.
We'll hold you to that. We want to talk a little bit about what's going on in St. Louis, and I know you're very, very familiar with that. Lisa, it seems to me that the Michael Brown incident has sort of overtaken the Trayvon Martin story that you've just written about.
Right. So the title of my book, as you said, is Suspicion Nation, and the subtitle is The Inside Story of the Trayvon Martin Injustice and Why We Continue to Repeat It. And, you know, I wish I had been wrong. I wish we didn't continue to repeat it. The book came out in February, and I see so many similarities between the Trayvon Martin case and the Michael Brown case. I've written about it, by the way. I also blog for Avvo.com, where I'm a legal analyst. And in the Trayvon Martin case, you know, I was able to watch the whole trial beginning to end and then again on tape and review all of the evidence. And so I came to the conclusions that I did in my book about what an injustice it was and how the prosecution bungled that case. In the Mike Brown case, we're really still towards the beginning of the case. The grand jury has been meeting in secret, so we don't know all of the evidence. We only have a piece of the picture right now. But based on what we see so far, I am concerned.
You talk about repeating it, and Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin are not the only recent cases. We can look to Eric Garner in New York, a similar kind of situation. What is going on? Why are we repetitive in this particular area?
Well, there's a number of problems. One is the prevalence of guns in America. So the United States has more guns per capita than any other country on earth by far. Number two is Yemen, a distant second. And as a result, we have more gun violence. And as a result of all of that gun violence, the police are more afraid. Our police are more armed, and they're more likely to be confronted by somebody with a gun or to perceive that someone has a gun when perhaps they do not. So we see countries in Western Europe like France, Germany, that have zero police shootings per year, or one or two, and we have hundreds. And part of the reason for that is that people in those countries are not armed. So the police have less reason to be in fear. Another problem in the U.S. is that our police are trained to use lethal force in situations where I believe non-lethal force could be used to protect the police without taking a human life. So many people say in the Mike Brown shooting, for example, why did he have to shoot to kill? Even if he believed, even if Darren Wilson believed that Mike Brown was charging him or rushing at him, which is Darren Wilson's story, apparently, why did he have to kill him? Couldn't he have shot an arm or a leg or tasered him? Well, the fact is that our police across America are trained when they shoot to kill, because when you're shooting, you're supposed to be shooting only to protect your own life, not just to maim or disable someone. That's a problem. And then the third biggest part of the problem is implicit racial bias. And this is something I talk about a great deal in my book, that most of us think that we are not racist, that one is either racist or one is not. But in fact, there is a third alternative, which is the presence of implicit racial bias, something that psychologists from Harvard University and elsewhere have tested and really perfected over about 15 years. And it turns out about 75% of white Americans test for moderate or severe racial bias against African Americans. And surprisingly, so do about half of African Americans, that is, test for racial bias against their own group. So these are deep-seated biases. These are fears that African Americans are violent when they are not. We're talking about seeing, and I use that word with quotation marks around it, seeing a gun in the hands of an African American person when it doesn't exist. There's a lot of data about that, and that's a big problem. But the good news is it's a problem that we can overcome.
Well, how do we do that? I mean, the NRA is certainly active enough and has been to prevent any meaningful gun legislation.
Well, that's partly true, and I would take issue with part of that. So And again, I talk about this extensively in my book. The NRA is not really as effective as many Americans believe. There was a study by the Sunlight Foundation a couple of years ago that showed that many of the candidates that the NRA supported had lost, and many of the initiatives that the NRA supported had failed. Most Americans, for example, including most NRA members, support background checks for guns, support licensing and safety regulations on guns. So there is common ground that I believe many of us can support to tighten up gun regulations. Many people believe that the Second Amendment prohibits legislatures from passing any laws to restrict guns. That's not true. In fact, the Supreme Court case, the Heller case from 2008, that did uphold Second Amendment rights of Americans to have guns in our homes, also upheld many, many exceptions to that, including concealed carry or open carry, as I said, background checks, requiring locks, requiring parents to lock up guns in their home. And I think a lot of these common sense safety rules could minimize gun violence. We're not going to reduce it down to zero in America, but we can. There's a lot we can do around the edges to reduce those numbers. When we talk about racial bias, which I think really is the root of the issues when we're talking about Mike Brown or Trayvon Martin or so many others, as you've named, there are pilot programs in some cities like Chicago where police are trained to recognize their own implicit racial biases, and they do have very positive effects. Let me give you an example outside of law enforcement. Doctors, we know, tend to spend about twice as much time with white patients as with black patients. More likely to send whites to a specialist for a problem than blacks when they present with the same symptoms. When they're confronted with this information, doctors generally are horrified, as any of us would be. And the good news is that they can change their behavior, and they do change their behavior when this is brought to their attention. Because most of us today really don't want to be racist. We don't want these kinds of outcomes. I myself took the implicit racial bias test online. It's free. It takes 15 minutes. I encourage everybody to do that. And, you know, when you take that test and you get a result that you don't like, it really does have an effect on you. And I think that when law enforcement does that, I think it needs to be a continuing education program. And everybody should be aware of our racial biases. By the way, there's also gender biases, sexual orientation biases, the list goes on and on. But we really can do something about it. All is not lost. This is not a hopeless problem.
But is it something that can be done by the average citizen or something that has to be done by the authorities that you're talking about, the police who are in direct contact with the people accused of wrongdoing?
Well, it's a particularly urgent problem when we're talking about police because we entrust police with a badge and a gun, and we have too much violence against civilians, and particularly unarmed civilians, and in particular, unarmed African-American males. Too many shot and killed, and once that life is lost, it can never come back. And I think we're all exhausted from seeing grieving mothers crying over an 18-year-old in the case of Mike Brown, a 17-year-old in the case of Trayvon Martin. Those stories are horrifying. And so we have to take action. And the action that can be taken, as I say, is training police in non-lethal force, teaching them racial sensitivity and diversity training. And I would also add, you know, in 2014, there should be a camera on the lapel or the badge of every police officer in America. There's really no excuse for us to be doing 20th century investigations like we're doing in the Mike Brown case, interviewing witnesses, you know, poring over the crime scene, trying to piece it together after the fact, when we have 21st century technology that can answer these questions for us.
What do you make of the process, as far as you know it, that's been taking place here with regard to the grand jury, a prosecutor who seems to, many people have accused of being having an inherent bias because of his father having been killed by a black man some years ago?
Well, that's part of it. I don't think that alone would be sufficient, but I think his many close ties to law enforcement, his apparent lack of enthusiasm for prosecuting this case, means that he should have recused himself. When tens of thousands of people are signing a petition in a hot-button case asking you to recuse yourself, you should, because we need the appearance of impropriety, not only from judges, but from all of law enforcement in this case. This is a highly sensitive case. It's an important case to the community and to the country. I think he should have recused himself. And I question some of the choices that this prosecutor has made. And that's why I do compare this to the Trayvon Martin case, where I think the prosecutors there did a very poor job in that case. I think there was no advocate for Trayvon Martin in that courtroom. The prosecutors failed to prepare their witnesses. They failed to cross-examine witnesses. They failed to put on expert witnesses who were dying to testify. identify, and I have all of that information in my book. And most importantly, they failed to give the jury a roadmap to conviction, which is the prosecutor's job. Well, in the Mike Brown case, I'm concerned that some of this may be, and I emphasize may be repeating itself, because we know that the prosecutor could have filed charges himself, right? He didn't do that. That would have been followed by a preliminary hearing, which is generally a one-day affair. That's a public hearing. Everybody could have seen it. So he opted not to do that. He opted for the grand jury, which is one day a week, taking a very long time, and it's a secret proceeding. So, of course, that raises everyone's suspicions as to what's going on there. We also know that the prosecutor has said that he's putting all of the evidence out there and he's going to let the grand jury decide. So this is highly unusual at the grand jury phase. What usually happens is the prosecutor reviews the evidence, because that's his job. He comes to his own conclusion about what charges should be filed. He puts that case on very briefly with just a couple of witnesses in front of the grand jury. He then gives them that roadmap to probable cause, which is all that's needed at the grand jury phase. And the grand jury usually agrees. Now, I should emphasize the prosecutor does have the duty to disclose exculpatory evidence, evidence that helps the defense. And of course, that has to be done as well. But there is really no reason to put on all of the evidence as if this were the full-blown trial if one believes that charges should be filed. And, you know, jurors aren't stupid. Jurors pick up on the cues that a prosecutor puts out there in a grand jury. The prosecutor is the only representative of the justice system in that grand jury room. And I think he's sending a very clear signal to the grand jury that this is a tough case, read reasonable doubt, that, you know, this is a complicated case. And all of that indicates that perhaps in the minds of the grand jurors, they're going to get the message that charges should not be filed. Listen, there are 6 eyewitnesses who have come forward to say Mike Brown had his hands in the air in the universal sign of surrender when he was shot. The ordinary preliminary hearing would be you put a couple of those witnesses on, you put on somebody who's investigated it, you say, judge, this is enough for probable cause. The judge says you're right, and then you go to trial.
Couple that with the fact that the officer himself testified before the grand jury, and a lot of people found that to be unusual. Do you?
I do find that to be unusual, and I find that to be another sign that the officer and his attorney feel that it's close enough to a call of no charges being filed that it was worth that risk. So they have that indication. Now, you know, I want to emphasize, we don't know all of the evidence. We only know what's been made public. But based on what's been made public and the 6 witnesses who saw Mike Brown with his hands in the air at the time that he was shot, it does seem to me that there is sufficient probable cause. And I haven't seen any witnesses come forward to say something different.
Yeah. What do you make of the demonstrations that have followed and have persisted? Some people here who've been around for a while have suggested that this case is a little different than some of the others, Trayvon Martin in particular, and some of the others over the years, that there is a sustainability to the anger here. Mm-hmm. Do you detect that? You're from Los Angeles,
yes.
You're not from here, and that complicates things, but obviously you've been following it.
I have been following it very closely. Listen, I respect and admire the peaceful protesters. There's always going to be some bad apples in any civil rights struggle. Nobody advocates violence. I don't advocate violence. But I see the peaceful protesters as the latest in a long line of people who have struggled to move this country forward, whether it was in the 1950s and 60s, the civil rights protesters, women who demonstrated, and some of them threw themselves in front of horses to get the right to vote. You know, these are people who are bringing important issues to national attention, and I salute them for it. You're right, it's not just about the shooting of Mike Brown, although that alone, I think, would be sufficient for protest, because this is an unarmed kid who was shot and killed, his body left in the street for 5 hours, and that's just appalling. But the lack of diversity in that police force is a concern. The sort of pettiness of police hassling generally the poor in America, this is not just a Ferguson issue, for things like jaywalking, or in other cases, public drunkenness, or, you know, these really petty crimes where people feel hassled and abused and singled out, I think that has to stop.
Yeah, part of the problem here, and I have to take a break, has been the realization on the part of a lot of people who didn't realize it before that people were being hassled, poor people hassled with traffic tickets and mm-hmm. arrest warrants and spending time in jail and coming out or losing their job before they came out. And that just exacerbates a problem that's already bad. Lisa Bloom is our guest. She is in town for an appearance tonight at the Missouri History Museum's Lee Auditorium. She is going to be discussing her book, Suspicion Nation, Race and Diversity Issues in St. Louis. That's what we're talking about here on St. Louis on the Air. We'll come back, continue this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Lisa Bloom in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Illinois Department of Public Health announced today that it plans to launch a hotline to answer the public's questions about Ebola. Department officials say the hotline will be operating by later this week. A group of economic development professionals from Detroit visiting St. Louis today to meet with several organizations about opportunities and challenges faced by both cities. They're hoping to learn some lessons from St. Louis officials and business representatives that can be used in Detroit. And AT&T today announced a multi-year financial contribution to support the expansion of a college readiness system in 6 St. Louis public schools. The system helps prepare low-income minority students at risk of dropping out for success in high school and college. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stopublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Lisa Bloom. Lisa, you're obviously very passionate about this subject and these subjects that we've been discussing. What brought you to that point?
Well, I'm a civil rights lawyer. I have been since 1986, and I have a law practice in Los Angeles and New York, and I've spent my career almost 30 years fighting for women, lesbians and gays, people of color, disabled people, and so I'm passionate about all of it. But I have to say, when it comes to race, we're still talking about life and death so often. And I guess that's what really makes me so passionate. You know, NBC asked me to cover the George Zimmerman trial last year, and I came into it with an open mind because I believe very strongly in the presumption of innocence and reasonable doubt, and I think we have a culture of mass incarceration. And so I don't want to see anyone incarcerated unless there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The evidence in that case came in so poorly, and so many mistakes were made by the prosecutors in that case. I had to dig deeper. I had to find out what was really going on. And that's what led me into the deep exploration of the issues in that case for my book. It's something I've been writing about and speaking about and talking about a great deal. And I think this issue of implicit racial bias is really at the root of so much of it. We have this problem in America of so much continued racism, especially in the criminal justice system. And, you know, the one system that's dedicated to equality, where we have those scales of justice on the outside of every building. And yet the outcomes are so different for African Americans. Just one example, when we're talking about juveniles, children, African Americans are 6 times more likely to be sentenced to a long term as juveniles than whites for the same crimes. Blacks and whites use marijuana at about the same rates, but blacks are 4 times as likely to be incarcerated for it. So we clearly have a problem, but this is a problem that we have created, and it's a problem that we can solve. And I think that's where my passion comes from.
There's just been a major study conducted here in St. Louis showing that in certain zip codes, the poor zip codes, if you will, that the people who live in those zip codes live 18 fewer years than those who live in more affluent areas.
So this is heartbreaking. And Martin Luther King said, all we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. I think we all believe in the values of equality. That's the good news. We all want to eradicate racism. That's the good news. But we have to open to our eyes to its continued existence. And many people really don't want to do that. They want to believe that we have already achieved it. And there's just a mountain of evidence to show that we have not.
You know, I'll go back to the demonstrations here, because it's been the observation of many that as more and more people take to the streets and persist in the demonstrations, there are a lot of white people who look at that and are getting really tired of it. Mm-hmm. And if they were potential allies a month ago, they are less so now. And a lot of it has to do, I think, so I'm told, with the kind of thing you're talking about.
Well, I'm sure people are tired of demonstrations. I think the African-American community is tired of seeing its children gunned down in the streets and there being a lack of accountability. I think those who are getting weary, I would encourage to really listen carefully to what the protesters are talking about. Listen, I'm a white woman. I talk about race. People say to me, you know, aren't you scared? Aren't you worried you're going to say the wrong thing? And, you know, I understand that concern. I think the first part of all of this has to be for those of us who are not African American to really listen, to read, to hear the concerns of the community, and to understand that peaceful demonstrations are as American as apple pie. Peaceful demonstrations are really something we can be proud of in America, that we have the right to do that. You know, look at what's going on in China or Hong Kong or many countries around the world where demonstrators are imprisoned. We have the right to demonstrate, and that's one of the best things in America.
Let's take some calls as we can, as time will allow. We have Charles joining us from Chesterfield. Charles, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Howdy. Two things. The author doesn't seem to know that Brown was hit four times in the right arm out of the six shots. Second thing is there was a piece on PBS sometime in the last week, I think it was PBS, about the insanity of Trayvon Martin's case being a little bit more than racism, in that a white guy got 20 years mandatory sentencing for firing a warning shot to protect his family. He hurt no one, mm-hmm. but he's put away for 20 years because of mandatory sentencing. So if you stand your ground in Florida, you better kill a guy because you're going to get put away forever.
Right. So, listen, I think that 20 years for a warning shot when no one is harmed is insanity and a terrible injustice. I am familiar with the autopsy results. There's been three autopsies, as I understand it, and I think not all of them have been released. But you're right, some of it has been released. And what we do know is that there was a shot on the inside of Mike Brown's forearm and also one in his right palm. That would be consistent with him either being shot from behind, because his arm, that part of his arm would have been behind him as he was running, or with his hands up in the air, and therefore you'd be shot in the palm and the underside of your arm. So either of those would be consistent. There is, you know, some timelines that journalists have put together indicate that there were a number of shots at him that missed. He then turned and he was shot with his hands up, and the final fatal shot was to the apex of his head, the crown of his head, as he was going down.
Isn't it dangerous, however, to try to speculate on what happened when we have so many different stories?
Yes, in part, and no, in part. So, yes, I don't want to reach any conclusions in the Mike Brown case until we have all of the evidence. And because the prosecutor opted for a secret grand jury, we don't have all of the evidence. Because the police department has failed to do an incident report, we don't have all of the evidence. That's on them, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we need transparency. Police should do an incident report when somebody is shot and killed. However, we can talk about the evidence that we know. And I really am waiting to hear a response to those six eyewitnesses that saw him shot with his hands up, because that's really the crux of the case.
Even under most circumstances, it's really very difficult to indict a police officer in use of force cases, isn't it?
It is. It's difficult to get an indictment. It's difficult to get a conviction. You know, in the George Zimmerman case, the community was so relieved when George Zimmerman was charged. It was 45 days of grassroots organizing and demonstrating and tweeting to get him charged. And when he was charged, everyone breathed a sigh of relief. I didn't, because I know that that's just the beginning. The case still has to be proved at trial. And that grassroots organization, you know, that can't get inside the prosecutor's office and make them do their job behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. I'm a trial lawyer myself. I know it's generally about 100 hours of work for every 1 hour of trial. And are they doing that work? Can we make them do that work? Can we make them believe in a case that they don't believe in? I think the answer in the George Zimmerman case was no. You know, my book, I have a chapter about an expert witness who wanted to testify to refute some of the defense expert testimony who wasn't allowed to. Key witnesses like Rachel Gentel, Trayvon Martin's friend, who was not at all prepared for her testimony, and so she testified poorly. I mean, there's really no excuse for that. So even in this case, if Darren Wilson is charged, are the prosecutors going to do that same kind of lackadaisical job, and will the case result in an acquittal? That's the question.
And of course, everyone here is wondering what happens if he is not charged.
And what happens if he is not charged is a very good question. You know, if the evidence continues to look the way it looks right now, I think peaceful demonstrations are appropriate.
Yeah. You came away then, I guess. I'm sorry, I have not read your book.
Yet.
I will. Yet. And I will. But I gather you came away thinking that George Zimmerman got away with murder.
I do think that. And I think that based on the evidence in the case. You know, one of the most important pieces of evidence in that case was the videotape of George Zimmerman the day after the shooting, where he indicated that his gun was holstered behind him inside the waistband of his pants. And it was a matte black gun, meaning not shiny, matte, a matte black holster. And it was a rainy night on the grass. George Zimmerman said he was down on his back. Trayvon Martin was straddling him, knees to armpits. That Trayvon Martin saw the gun, reached for the gun, and therefore George Zimmerman had to grab his gun and shoot in self-defense. Well, unless Trayvon Martin had X-ray vision, there is no way he saw through the bulk of George Zimmerman's body to a gun holstered behind him. That was a key fact in the case. That was a smoking gun fact in the case that the prosecution failed to argue. And you have to ask yourself, why did they fail to argue that? They had such a powerful piece of evidence. Why didn't they put that videotape up in closing argument? Why didn't they spend a half an hour on that in closing argument and really make it painfully clear to the jury that George Zimmerman was lying about the most important fact of the case? And that's just one example of many of how they misstepped.
And your conclusion as to why they didn't?
Well, I have a couple of conclusions. I let my reader come to that conclusion. I will say that Angela Corey, in that case, the lead prosecutor, after it was over, she smiled broadly for the cameras and said the system worked. It's a very odd thing to say when your team has just lost the biggest trial of the year. Only one of the four prosecutors expressed disappointment with the verdict. I don't think they believed in the case from the beginning. Other people who have read my book argue to me that they intentionally blew the case. So I'm going to let the reader come to his or her own conclusion on that.
We have an email from Pat here I'll read to you. It's very brief. Besides race, would Lisa consider that there may be an issue of how the police interact with the public? For example, Bryce Masters in Independence, Missouri, or David Hooks in East Dublin, Georgia. You may not be familiar with those cases, but you get the gist of what she's asking.
Yes, and listen, the young man who was with Mike Brown says this confrontation began when Darren Wilson said to them as they were walking down the middle of the street on a sunny Sunday afternoon, "Get the F onto the sidewalk." You know, if that's true, it's a very rude way to speak to a member of the community, you know, whose only crime is jaywalking. I have just visited a client in prison in Los Angeles a couple times, and I experienced that same kind of rude treatment from law enforcement. And I'm just an attorney, a law-abiding person going to visit someone. I see mothers with little toddlers going in to visit people being treated with a high level of rudeness. I just wrote about that on avo.com. So, you know, certainly law enforcement needs to behave respectfully to the community that it serves.
Can you name any place where they're doing it right?
Well, I can name a couple of good things. I know that Chicago, for example, has a good program on racial diversity training, and I talk about that in my book. I would give a shout out to Rialto, California, who has dash cams and I believe body cams on their officers, and that pilot program has reduced use of force complaints 80%. Why? Because I think people behave better when they know they're on camera. And also, good cops are protected from false complaints when you know there is a camera. So, you know, I don't see how anyone can be against cameras, both on the person of an officer and on the car.
Of course, the officer has to remember to turn the camera on, which was an incident here recently in which he failed to do that.
Yeah, listen, I have two use of force cases right now that I'm litigating. And in both of them, the officer, claims that the batteries were dead on his audio recording device. I think keeping your equipment in proper working order is part of the job, and if you fail to do it, you're not competent to keep that job.
Another call. Peter in St. Louis joins us. Go ahead, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I was just calling to make a comment that I think the focus of all these problems is directed in the wrong areas. I believe we need to be more focused on how we're raising our children. I think fathers need to be actively involved in being role models and raising their children properly to keep them out of the legal system so they're not running with gangs, they're not doing drugs, they're not doing things that are illegal. And that is something that there has been no focus on, and it's something that if we are going to address these problems, we need to talk about how we go about raising our children to be good citizens. And if we start there, I think a lot of these other issues that are issues, racism in our legal system, but these problems won't get to the legal system if we're raising our children properly. And that's the hardest job there is in this world, to raise children properly. But I think that's what we're failing to do, and a lot more focus needs to be, especially on the fathers being present in these children's lives, their daughters and their sons.
Peter, thank you. We take that comment. We're running out of time, and I want to give Lisa Bloom a chance to respond.
Well, hear, hear. Listen, my second book is called Swagger, and it's about raising boys, and I have a plea at the end for fathers to be more connected in their sons' lives, even if they have been absent for a while. Come back. Your sons and your daughters need you. Having said that, in the case of Trayvon Martin, he was actually with his father. He was staying with his father out of town. They went to go visit the father's girlfriend, and he was a 17-year-old, so his father and the girlfriend went to a movie, and Trayvon went to a convenience store to buy candy and a soda, and he was just walking back. So he did not lack a father in his life. We certainly need more fathers. I'd like every father to spend a lot more time with his children, but there are also a lot of serious issues involving race, and especially in the criminal justice system.
One more quick call, this one from Teresa in St. Louis. Go ahead, Teresa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Don. You're a phenomenal reporter.
Thank you.
The previous caller, I certainly hear and understand what he's saying, but that's also changing a family dynamic, which will take a long time. When people are being serving long, hard time for not committing a crime against their fellow human being, like murder, it's hard for them to be a father. And when they have a felony conviction and trying to obtain a job, one full-time job is extremely difficult. And I am a white person growing up in West County, but my eyes were wide open working in Chicago for many years. And coming back to St. Louis, which I love, I still see a lot of racism, and you can't deny it. I have an uncle who committed murder. He will be paroled in less than 14 years served. This was not in self-defense. The man was upset in a situation at a bar, went out to his car, retrieved his gun, came back in and shot the man point blank and tried to shoot another man. And it's tough to say that this is a family member of mine, but we're both white, and he will be paroled in less than 15 years served. And I know there are people of other color who are serving hard time, long time, for not even committing murder.
Thanks for the call, Teresa.
Right. There's no doubt that in our criminal justice system, blacks are more likely to be charged, they're more likely to be convicted, and they're more likely to be sentenced to longer prison terms. In death penalty cases, they're more likely to get the death penalty, especially if the victim is white. There's just a mountain of studies about racial bias in the criminal justice system, and they all go in the same direction, which is there's a tremendous racial bias. I also like the caller's point about fathers, because, you know, we have a culture of mass incarceration in America. We incarcerate more of our own people than any other country on earth or in human history. And as a result, many fathers are forcibly separated from their children. In the federal system, for example, the majority of people are in for nonviolent drug crimes. And, you know, this piece I mentioned that's on avvo.com I just wrote about is about fathers being separated from their children. And just kind of the petty cruelty of the prison system having posters in the visiting room exhorting fathers to spend more time with their children. This is to incarcerated fathers. I don't know how they're supposed to spend more time with their children. It seems to me just one of those little slaps in the face that the prison system wanted to inflict on inmates.
We only have a few seconds left, Lisa, and I will point out again that you'll be speaking about your book tonight, Suspicion Nation, Race and Diversity Issues in St. Louis. You're not from St. Louis. What do you see from afar that you're going to be talking about with regard to our situation here?
Well, I don't want to opine too much about St. Louis because you're right. I'm an out-of-towner, and I'm sure you don't appreciate out-of-towners coming in and you know, wagging their finger at you. So that's not my goal. My book is called Suspicion Nation because it's about the nationwide problems. I think there is a problem in St. Louis. I think there is a problem in New York and Miami and Los Angeles and across the nation when it comes to shootings, in particular, of unarmed African Americans. But there are also nationwide solutions. So I hope everyone will come. It's a free event. You know, why do you live in a big city if you don't go out to free events and hear authors speak live? Get off of Facebook just for one night and come out and hear us at 5:30 p.m. at the History Museum.
Okay. I've got it at 6:45. So
well, 6:45 is when I speak. 5:30 is when the events start. There's a lot going on before me.
All right. That's at the museum, Missouri History Museum's Lee Auditorium tonight. Lisa Bloom, thanks so much for being with us. Enjoy your time in St. Louis. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Dr. Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, like his grandfather, a champion of nonviolence. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.